Buying or selling your home? Real Estate for Life can connect you with a pro-life real estate agent. When Real Estate for Life receives a referral fee, they donate 65% to Catholic Answers. Learn more at realestateforlife.org. Hello and welcome to Catholic Answers Live on this Friday between Ascension Thursday and Ascension Sunday. So I don't know. Is this part of the Ascension? I don't know how that works. I'm not a good liturgist, but we're happy you're here with us. Thanks very much for being here with us. And you're going to be happy you're here with us, too, because we got Jimmy Akin both hours. It's Ask Me Anything with Jimmy Akin, but you better dial quickly. Just two lines open right now, 888-318-7884, 888-318-7884. I paused only because we have the old phone number on the sheet. The phone number for the pledge drive is on the sheet. I almost gave out the pledge drive number. 888-318-7884. You can call and ask whatever you want, and anybody can call. It's called Catholic Answers Live, but you don't have to be Catholic to call. If you've got a question for Jimmy Akin, we would love to get you on the line. 888-318-7884. Jimmy Akin, the senior apologist here at Catholic Answers, the man behind Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World and the Jimmy Akin podcast and all kinds of wonderful books, including, the Bible is a Catholic Book and A Daily Defense, 365 Days Plus One to Becoming a Better Apologist. And I think tomorrow, I don't have a clear memory on this, but I think tomorrow maybe 31 years doing this job. Hello, Jimmy Akin.
Hello, Cy Kellett. How you doing?
I'm doing very well.
31 years tomorrow is, it will be my 31st anniversary at Catholic Answers.
Congratulations, 31 years.
Thank you.
You are I think you're the world record host. I mean, the world record holder for Catholic radio apologetics. I would challenge anyone to say they've been doing it longer than you have, Jimmy. But we have another anniversary today. Darren, today is his 20th anniversary. Can you believe that?
Hey!
He looks like a baby, and he's been here 20 years doing this.
Congratulations, Darren.
Yeah. Also, Darren, thank you because the ladies in customer service got us cupcakes because it's your 20th. So thank you for that, Darren. 888-318-7884 is the number, 888-318-7884. I think I'll start in Denver, Colorado today. Audrey's in Denver, Colorado, listening on the Catholic Answers Live app. I think we have spoken a few times before, Audrey. Is that correct?
Yes, it is.
Well, it's nice
How
to speak.
Are you?
Very well. Thank you. Thank you. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hi, Jimmy. So I just finished reading John Bergsma's book, Jesus and the Dead Sea Scrolls. And mm-hmm. in the chapter on the Eucharist, he mentions or proposes an alternate Holy Week chronology that mm-hmm. possibly Jesus might have had the Last Supper on Tuesday because that lines up with the lunar Essene calendar for Passover better. I was just curious, given your interest in Bible chronology, about your opinion. Mm-hmm.
Well, I'm aware of various chronologies for Holy Week, and I was a little surprised to hear you say the Essene lunar calendar, because one of the distinctives of the Essene community, at least based on the Dead Sea Scrolls, we assume that it was the Essenes who wrote the Dead Sea Scrolls, is that they were not fans of using the moon as part of their calendar to determine the dates of things. That's what they did at the temple in Jerusalem. Every month began with the new moon, and there was a procedure that they had to determine the new moon. In fact, I talked about this some in episode 365 of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World recently, which is all about the mystery of the year and how the year works. But they would actually, at Jerusalem, they would throw big dinners for witnesses to come, young people with good eyesight, to come every month and tell the temple authorities if they'd seen the new moon. And they had tests that they would ask, trick questions that they would ask to see if the testimony was credible. And if it was, they would announce, okay, the new moon has been sighted, and so the new month begins. But what that had the effect of doing was shifting the days of the week on which various holidays were celebrated. And the Dead Sea Scrolls authors were not in favor of that. Instead, they were in favor of a calendar that was used, for example, it's described, for example, in the Book of Jubilees, where it's a 364-day calendar and it is not tied to what the moon is doing in the sky. So you could, for example, have Passover fall on, you know, Wednesday, or the first of the month would fall on Wednesday of every single month. So I'm a little confused by that. Of course, in order to review John Bergsma's proposal, I'd have to read what he wrote about it. But I am pretty confident that I would still adhere to the traditional chronology, which has Jesus being crucified on a Friday instead of a Wednesday. Sometimes people will appeal to a passage in John to cast doubt on that, and they'll say, well, the temple authorities, John says, hadn't yet eaten the Passover meal as of Friday morning. And so since Jesus had already eaten the Passover meal, he must have been using a different calendar than they did. But I think that's an erroneous inference, because the authorities that tried Jesus did not know when the arrest was going to happen. And so they hung out all night waiting for it to happen, and that's why they hadn't eaten yet. What you can show from the Gospels, and I plan to do a future episode of the Jimmy Akin podcast on this, is that it really was Friday. You start with him being raised on Sunday, which is something all four Gospels say, and then you back up one day to Saturday as the Sabbath. And then you back up one more day, and that's in all four Gospels. You back up one more day in all four Gospels to what's called the Day of Preparation, which is a reference to Friday. And then you back up one more, and that's also the day of the crucifixion, and then you back up one more day to the Last Supper, and it occurred on Thursday. So I don't see good evidence for alternative chronologies. I'm happy to consider them, but after looking at this very carefully, I think the traditional chronology is the one best supported by the evidence.
Okay, Audrey?
Yep. Oh, dear. I may have missed it. I'll go back and reread the chapter, but thank you very much for your insights as well.
Audrey, no problem.
Thanks. Great talking with you. And I hope we'll talk with you again soon. Here's somebody we get to talk to from time to time as well. And usually it's on a Friday afternoon, because it's Saturday morning where Luke is in Seoul, South Korea, just after 7 o'clock in the morning in Seoul. Good morning, Luke.
Good morning, Sai and Jimmy. Good morning.
Good morning. It's been a while. I'm glad you're back. And I see you have kind of a topical question for Jimmy.
Yeah. I'm happy to be back.
Yeah, it's nice.
All right, Jimmy. My question is about the conclave. Why does the church have to make the election of a new pope secret? Does it have any reason for that?
Well, I think that there are two reasons that that contribute to the secrecy of a conclave. One of them is that they really want the cardinals to not be influenced by outside factors. They want the cardinals to be able to withdraw and open, you know, and discuss and pray and open themselves to God's will about who the best pope would be. And they don't want them being pressured by outside forces, whether that's lay people or other clergy or secular rulers. And so getting them all alone and cutting off communication is one way of keeping them from being pressured. I think there's also a second reason, which is that once a pope has been elected, it's perceived as better if you don't publish the results of the, if you don't publish the vote totals, because popes are elected when they achieve a certain number of votes. And if you knew that, oh, well, there was still this other chunk of cardinals and it was this big, maybe this pope only just got over the threshold by the time of the final vote, but there were all these other cardinals that didn't vote for him, then that could sow the seeds of disunion in the church. And it's easier to support a new pope if we're just told, here's what they elected, here's the new guy, and we're not told, oh, except this percentage of the cardinals disagreed with this, because then that could become an object of focus for people who aren't happy with the new pope, and it could breed division and disunity in the church.
Luke, thanks. I was going to go back to Luke and I dropped him. I'm sorry, Luke. I pushed the wrong button. Oh, my goodness. Let me take a break. We'll be right back with more Ask Me Anything with Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live.
Catch Catholic Answers Live anytime at Catholic.com.
Are you looking to study Catholic theology in a formal way with the guidance of faithful scholars? Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by the Augustine Institute, offering master's degrees in theology, pastoral theology, and Catholic education with flexible study options on campus, online, or both. The Augustine Institute equips students to serve Christ and His church in schools, parishes, dioceses, apostolates, and the home. Learn more today at augustine.edu.
Are you a coffee drinker? If so, you can now enjoy a coffee roasted to perfection by the Carmelite monks of Wyoming. Delicious Mystic Monk coffee is roasted and prepared by monks in a hidden cloistered monastery and is available in over 25 varieties. All Mystic Monk coffees are works of perfection and labors of love. For more information on how to purchase Mystic Monk coffee, visit mysticmonkcoffee.com. That's mysticmonkcoffee.com.
EWTN Radio Essentials is now EWTN Radio Extra. It's the past, present, and future of Catholic radio. You'll hear classic programs from Mother Angelica and Dr. Scott Hahn, plus timeless devotionals and award-winning podcasts from our partners on EWTN's Podcast Central. Listen now to EWTN Radio Extra on the EWTN app, on smart speakers, and on EWTN.com.
Back, Catholic Answers Live. It's Friday. All kinds of good things happen on Friday. One of them is a new episode of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World drops each Friday morning. What dropped this morning, Jimmy?
Well, we had it's a fifth Friday, so we had a Weird Questions episode in which we answer that ultimate weird question, why is lunch meat round when bread is square?
That is the ultimate, wow. All right, so it was weird questions today on Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. And don't even give a hint. Maybe people should go and listen. If you're serious about lunch meat, go listen to the episode. Find out why.
Or if you're serious about bread.
Yeah, right. And I actually remember the answer to that one, and it's very interesting why lunch meat ended up round and bread square. You can go to mysterious.fm. You know where to get. You probably do anywhere where you get podcasts. Just look for Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. Jimmy also has the Jimmy Akin podcast, and in addition to other things he does, and Mysterious World at his YouTube channel. So check it out—a whole channel devoted to one person. So what about the Jimmy Akin podcast? What we get this week on that?
This week, I did a look at something that came up in the debate I had with Bart Ehrman a few years ago, where he wanted to know, why in Matthew it sounds like Joseph's home is in Bethlehem, and why in Luke it sounds like Joseph's home is in Nazareth. And I said, well, Joseph had two homes. That's a straightforward resolution. And he said, huh. I'd never thought of that. So I went through in the most recent episode that came out last Monday. I went through the biblical evidence and I showed that you don't even need Matthew. Forget Matthew. Just read Luke. And Luke by himself implies that they had homes in both places. And so this is something that not a lot of people seem to have picked up on, but I thought it would be worth just taking a walk through the text of Luke. Say, let's read it a bit at a time and see what Luke is saying. And he implies that that Joseph had a home in Bethlehem, but Joseph and Mary together had a home in Nazareth, which is not at all uncommon for people who have to migrate for work. You know, like people, let's say they live in Sinaloa, Mexico, but they come to Arizona for work. Well, okay, they have their family home back in Sinaloa, but then they don't just stay on the street in Arizona. They find some kind of modest place to live, and so they maintain two homes, and they'll periodically go back to their family home, which is what Joseph is doing in Luke chapter 2 when he goes home for the census.
Ah, check it out. And again, wherever you get your podcasts, you can get the Jimmy Hagin podcast on Mondays, Jimmy Hagin's Mysterious World on Fridays. And you can also watch virtually any other podcast, and eventually Jimmy will show up on it. That might be a slight exaggeration, but Jimmy's on a lot of these.
Just a slight one.
Yeah. All right, back to the phones we go. Michael is in Columbia, South Carolina, watching on YouTube. We're glad you're here with us, Michael. Go ahead with your question.
Hey, Jimmy. I have a question. There are several points in the Bible where books that are not in the Bible are referenced. For example, at the end of First Chronicles, it references the Chronicles of Nathan and the Chronicles of Gad the seer. Are any of those texts available anywhere? Has any scholars found any of those texts? And what are we to make of Scripture referencing books that are not in Scripture?
Well, so these are books that did exist at one time, and the biblical authors considered them worth mentioning because they contained information that would be valuable to the ancient audience. In terms of were they divinely inspired or not, that's a more open question. I think in some cases you can argue that they would have been divinely inspired. For example, one of the books that's mentioned is by Iddo the seer. And since he was a seer, he was a prophet. And so this would have been a book of prophecy. And the one of Nathan that you mentioned would be another example of that. The Nathan in question is the prophet Nathan who confronted David about his adultery with Bathsheba. So I think that some of them may have been divinely inspired, but it apparently was not God's will for them to end up in the canon. And in fact, it appears that it was not God's will for them to survive to the present day. So we do not have any of these books. That has not stopped some people from trying to produce them. For example, one of the books that's mentioned in the Old Testament is called the Book of Jasher, which means the Book of the Upright. It looks like it was something like it may have been a book of kind of epic poetry or songs about things that God did for Israel. It appears to have been very early because it's mentioned in the Pentateuch in the first five books of the Bible. And later in Christian history, someone wrote a fake version of the Book of Jasher. But the Book of Jasher itself has been lost, and so we shouldn't look to the later fake as if it was given us, here's what the Book of Jasher actually said.
Okay, Michael?
Yeah, very interesting. It's fascinating to think that there is divinely inspired Scripture that, divinely inspired books that we'll never know about until we meet God.
The author.
It's at least arguable that there are.
You've done quite a bit of podcasting in the last year or so, Jimmy, on non-biblical books that are interesting to read.
Yes. Right?
And that's at Mysterious World that you did that? I can't remember which podcast you did it on. That's at Mysterious World?
Yeah, we have a loose ongoing series within Mysterious World about what we're calling lost scriptures. Now, they're not lost today. Otherwise, I couldn't devote episodes to them. Some of them have been rediscovered by scholars, but most people don't know about them, so they're lost in that sense. And they're not scripture in the sense they're not in the Catholic Bible, but they are or were considered scripture by some people. Examples of episodes I've done in that series include the book of Jubilees, the book of Enoch, First Enoch, the Ascension of Isaiah, the life of Adam and Eve, and most recently, First Esdras. So if you Google Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World, Lost Scriptures, all that kind of stuff's going to come up.
Michael, thank you. Thank you very much for the call and for the actually quite interesting question. Off to Hastings, Michigan we know, go now. Aaron is in Hastings, Michigan, watching on YouTube. Welcome back, Aaron. You got a question for Jimmy?
Yeah, and if I asked this before, forgive me. Where do we find the idea of purgatory other than Maccabees?
Well, if you were to go to Catholic.com and look up any of our many numerous online tracts about purgatory and other articles about purgatory, or Carlo Broussard's book about purgatory, or my book on the last things, my 20 Answers booklet, you would find that there are a number of passages besides Second Maccabees which Catholics have appealed to in support of the idea of purgatory. The most famous of them is 1 Corinthians 3, where St. Paul talks about how everyone's work is going to be tested by fire, and even if the man himself is saved, he may see all of his work go up in flames, which would not be a pleasant experience. And this would point to some kind of unpleasant purifying event in the afterlife. But the person is still saved, so they're still going to heaven. Paul says they're still saved. So even for the saved, something like this can happen. There are other passages, too, that people appeal to. Some of them have greater or lesser degrees of merit, in my opinion. Some people will appeal to the unforgivable sin passages, where Jesus says that a certain class of sin, it's basically where you refuse to repent and you just die unrepentant. But he says that that will not be forgiven either in this life or the next. And some people will look at that and say, aha, that means some sins get forgiven in the next life. But I don't think that's a good inference. And I don't use those verses when I'm talking with folks who don't believe in purgatory, because it's not required. If you say this is not going to happen in this life or the next, it just means it's never going to happen. It doesn't mean some things in this class happen in the next life. So I don't think you can infer purgatory from that. What I tend to do is talk first principles when I'm dealing with folks who don't believe in purgatory. And I say, well, look, I think we actually agree here. It's just we may use different language and different conceptualizations for it. But if someone's a fellow Christian, they'll typically acknowledge that they're not perfect right now, and they're not likely to be perfect at the moment of their death, but they will be perfect when they're in heaven. And that means that something must happen between death and heaven that makes them perfect. And whatever that thing is, that's what Catholics call purgatory. Now, it may happen in the twinkling of an eye, you know, which is a phrase that St. Paul sometimes uses. But the Catholic Church doesn't have any teaching about the length of purgatory. In fact, Pope Benedict XVI said you can't reckon it in earthly time. So even if it's just a momentary thing that happens super rapidly, it's still there, it's still real, and we actually agree about it. So I tend to go to first principles and then back up to look at particular biblical passages.
Okay, Aaron.
All right, thank you.
All right, thank you. Thanks for the call, Aaron. 888-318-7884 is the number. It's Ask Me Anything. Jimmy Akin is our guest, and off to St. Louis we go now. Ryan, also watching on YouTube. Ryan, glad you're here. Go ahead with your question.
Hey, good afternoon, gentlemen.
Good afternoon.
A tough question for Jimmy. Trying to determine which is more epic, your beard or your pipe collection. And I'm glad you.
That's a quiz. That's a question we need to pose to the listeners. Like Jimmy's.
Well, I would say if that's the choice, I would say it's the beard, because there are lots of guys who have pipe collections just as big as mine, but very few have beards just as big as mine.
On that note, the previous caller had mentioned purgatory. That was going to be my original question, so I'm going to pivot. And my wife and I were having a discussion. As you may know, I am Catholic in training, candidate for the church, and God willing, I'll be Catholic by next Easter.
So
we're having a discussion. Yay. We were having a discussion when Jesus says to Peter, "You are Peter, and upon this rock I will build my church." Now, our discussion, I had indicated to her that it is my belief in teaching that Jesus is saying, Peter, I'm turning the church over to you, you know, and this is what has become the Catholic Church. And her argument, very well thought out, is that she was saying, no, the rock, the church, is the Word of God. And so I was hoping to get some clarity, so I can understand from where she's coming and what the church teaches. Thank you.
No problem. And we're coming up on a hard break. So what I'll do is give you a couple of recommendations. You're in luck. Next Monday's episode of the Jimmy Akin podcast is all about how we can show that Peter is the rock. And the following Mondays is about other passages in the New Testament that also deal with what the church is founded on. So I would say just wait till Monday, go to my YouTube page, youtube.com/Jimmy Akin. The new episode of the Jimmy Akin podcast will be out, and it'll deal all with a pivotal moment in my life that led to my conversion to Catholicism, where I realized there are structural factors in the text that mandate Peter be the rock. Even though I'd always said that wasn't the case, I had to change my opinion. So check out the next two episodes of the Jimmy Akin podcast.
And unfortunately, that brings us right to the break, kind of quick on that one. But we'll be right back with more Ask Me Anything with Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live. We hope that one of the things that we communicate here at Catholic Answers Live is that our Catholic faith allows us to be fully serious about all the problems we encounter in the church and in the world, but it also lets us have light hearts and maybe even mix in a bit of fun, and that is exactly what our good friend Joe Heschmeyer does in his popular podcast, Shameless Popery. You should check it out at shamelessjoe.com. Joe's got a deep grasp of the faith, of morals, the teachings of the church, all that. But he's also got a witty conversational style. He entertains and he informs. But you will leave equipped to better answer the most common challenges, misconceptions, and questions about the Catholic faith. He's got insightful guests. He does on-air debates. And he takes a close look into all the things that you want to know about as a Catholic living today. You'll walk away knowledgeable and filled with joy. Look for Joe on his YouTube channel. Check him out at shamelessjoe.com or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you like what you hear, become a patron.
Deepen your connection to the Church's holy days and seasons while you draw on the wisdom of the Church Fathers. Feasts of Our Fathers, the new book from Mike Aquilina and Adam Lucas, is a treasury of history, prayers, insights, and lessons that will bring you closer to the earliest of Catholic traditions. Take your prayer life and your solidarity with the Church, past and present, to a new level. Order your copy of Feasts of Our Fathers today at shop.catholic.com.
When the resurrected Jesus appeared to disciples on the road to Emmaus, they didn't recognize him until the breaking of the bread. The same is true today. In the Holy Eucharist, we really meet Jesus. In The Eucharist is Really Jesus, author Joe Heschmeyer explains how knowing Jesus in the Eucharist is the key to understanding all of Christian faith. Order your copy of The Eucharist is Really Jesus today at shop.catholic.com or get it at a good Catholic bookstore. Welcome back. Catholic Answers Live. Jimmy Akin is our guest, and it's Ask Me Anything this hour. You can call and ask Jimmy whatever you'd like, and anybody is welcome to call, 888-318-7884, if you're like, I have never called a show before, but I feel like that's fine. Give us a call. Maybe you never thought of yourself as calling a Catholic radio show before. It's all right. Everybody's welcome. If you've got a question you'd like to talk with Jimmy about, just dial that number, 888-318-7884. You might have to dial a few times because the lines stay very full when Jimmy's here, but we'd love it if you'd take the time and call, and we could have that conversation with you that you've been wanting to have. 888-318-7884. Going down to Louisiana. Prentice is in Louisiana, listening on our website, catholic.com. Welcome, Prentice.
Hi, guys.
Hi.
The question that I have today is, what constitutes grave matter? Because I was always under the impression with mortal sin that it was knowledge of the sin and having like full will and deliberation in committing the sin. And I found certain verses that talk about like the deadly sins and what sins we should avoid. And I just feel like that graveness is, there's like a gray area, like it isn't fully defined. And I just want to make sure I'm not,
on the wrong side of that line.
Okay, so this is a question that's answered by the Catechism of the Catholic Church, and you can look up the Catechism if you don't have a personal copy. You can go to the Vatican's website or just type in Catechism of the Catholic Church, and it'll come up. If you type in Catechism of the Catholic Church and the words grave matter, it'll probably get you a direct link to the passage you need to go to. But basically, grave matter is any kind of sin that would gravely harm a good. That good could be towards God, you know, like rejecting belief in God, you know, that gravely damages the good of believing in God. It also could be directed against another human being, like doing grave harm to another human being, whether it's mental harm or financial harm or physical harm or whatever it may be. But basically, in terms of a practice, so that's the underlying principle. It does grave damage to some good. But in terms of a practical list, the church, and this is what the Catechism mentions, says that it's summarized by the Ten Commandments. So the principles that are involved in the Ten Commandments involve the categories that can potentially have grave matter. So, for example, lying, stealing, murdering, committing adultery. All of those represent, now, some of the categories are a little broader, like adultery, well, just some kind of sexual sin. Sexual sins are one kind that a person can commit mortal sin through, even if they're not married and thus wouldn't be committing adultery, you know, if they're, say, fornicating with somebody. But the categories of morality that have grave matter to them are summarized, or can have grave matter to them, are summarized by the Ten Commandments. But that doesn't mean that everything that infringes on the Ten Commandments in any way is going to be grave matter. You know, stealing is one of the things that's prohibited by the Ten Commandments. But if I stole a nickel from Elon Musk, the richest man in the world, that's not grave matter. I'm not doing grave damage to Elon Musk by stealing a nickel from him. On the other hand, if someone is starving on the street and only has a nickel to buy food today, and I steal his nickel, well, then I might be doing grave damage to him. So, you know, these things have to be dealt with some nuance, and not all violations of the Ten Commandments are grave. Some of them have what in theology, in moral theology, is called parvity of matter or smallness of matter. But in terms of what can be grave, it's basically all of the categories that are found in the Ten Commandments.
Okay. Prentice? I don't know
if
we
hear me?
Yeah, oh yeah. That makes sense to you, Prentice?
Yes, that makes a lot of sense.
Jimmy will do
Thank
that.
You guys.
That's why all the lines are full right now, Prentice, because Jimmy does that. 888-318-7884 from Louisiana. Let's head over to Houston, Texas, where I bet the weather's the same as it is in Louisiana. Dan, listening on 1430 AM. Welcome, Dan.
You know, I've been down around Houston, Texas, where the sun shines most of the time.
Yeah, is that what they say? Is that the sun shines most?
Well, that's what the Marshall Tucker Band says.
Oh, I didn't get the song reference. Is the sun shining, Dan?
It is today.
All right,
but it hasn't been. So you never know.
Well, we're glad you're here. Go ahead, Dan.
Thank you. I am a volunteer Protestant chaplain. Mm-hmm. And I have a ministry to those with Alzheimer's and dementia.
Mm-hmm. God bless
you. And in my congregation, if you will, there are both Protestants and Catholics. Mm-hmm. And I was wanting to find out, or curious to know, if there might be allowances made from time to time to allow a non-Catholic to present the elements of communion to Catholics that may be present. That's a good
okay.
way.
So is our it, it's there's this is something that I don't have the answer to off the top of my head. I'd need to check the official documents on this, and I can explain it a little further. But what I'd suggest is that you email me at jimmy@catholic.com, and I can then go check the documents and give you a clearer answer. But there are sort of two factors that need to be considered. The first factor is who performed the consecration of the elements. If you did, being a Protestant, the Catholic Church would say that we recognize the meaning that this has for you, and we recognize that that you know you're attempting to fulfill Christ's will, and that pleases Christ, and so forth. At the same time, as a Protestant minister, you wouldn't have the ordination necessary to confect the Eucharist the way the Catholic Church understands it, and Catholics are required to receive communion that has been consecrated in the way the Catholic Church understands it, which is typically from a Catholic minister, but it could also be like an Eastern Orthodox or an Oriental Orthodox minister. Unfortunately, not in the Protestant community, really. So if it's been validly consecrated, that clears one hurdle. But if it hadn't been validly consecrated, if it's something that, you know, that was consecrated by a Protestant minister, that could not be given to Catholics that you're ministering to. On the other hand, let's suppose it has been validly consecrated. Well, the standard procedure in that circumstance is for a Catholic, it could be a priest, could be a deacon, could be a layperson, to bring the Eucharist to those who aren't able to go to Mass to receive it. And in fact, if you go to a Catholic Mass, you'll often see at the end of the Mass, you know, people coming up in, who have been commissioned to do this. And you know, they will receive the host. Typically, it's in a little container to keep the host safe called a pyx, and they will take the pyx and take it to someone in a hospital or a nursing home or whatever it may be, and they'll administer communion to them right there. So you need to somehow get the properly consecrated host from a Catholic church to where you're ministering, and if that's happening, you may as well use one of these Catholic ministers who normally does this to achieve that. On the other hand, if that wasn't practical for some reason, could you go to a Catholic church and get it and bring it to these people? That's what I need to do more research on. I would kind of suspect it's not possible, and that the people who are commissioned to do this are required to be Catholic. But I'd need to check the documentation just to verify that. But what can happen, as I mentioned, is you can get Catholics to come and bring it to the people that you're ministering to. There's no problem with that at all. I would just contact a local Catholic church and say, hey, I have these people here. They're Catholic. They're not able to receive communion otherwise. Can we arrange for someone to bring them communion? And the local parish can help you navigate that.
Dan, thank you so much for the call and for the question, and God bless you in that ministry.
And thank you for your ministry to these people.
Yeah, what a beautiful ministry, Dan. I have to go to the break. We'll be right back with more Ask Me Anything with Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live.
This is Archbishop Paul Coakley, the Archdiocese of Oklahoma City, and you're listening to Catholic Answers Live.
Who was the first Catholic in your family? Were they evangelized by a friend, a coworker, a stranger? Did you ever think that you could be that person that God uses to save a soul, and that soul could save their family, their grandchildren, and generations to come? At St. Paul Street Evangelization, a Catholic nonprofit, we train, equip, and mobilize Catholic disciples to do the urgent work of evangelization. Catholic Answers is supported in part by St. Paul Street Evangelization, streetevangelization.com.
Hi, this is Father Mike Schmitz. Please join me for Ascension's Bible in a Year and Catechism in a Year here on EWTN Radio. We're going through the entire Bible and the Catechism in 365 days. If you've ever wanted to understand what it means to be Catholic and allow those truths to shape your life, this is for you.
Bible in a Year and Catechism in a Year with Father Mike Schmitz, tonight at 10 p.m. Eastern, 7 p.m. Pacific on EWTN Radio.
Welcome back, Catholic Answers Live. Always learning from Jimmy Akin. Learning during the break, just like I'm learning during the show. And I suppose I should share what I learned. I learned something about Star Trek, that in one of the episodes, there's an alien librarian in the episode, Dr. Atos.
And Jimmy, Mr. Atos.
Mr. Atos, yeah. He never finished the doctorate, huh? I know he worked at it, but—
Apparently not.
He's the librarian. But Atos, I never would have guessed it, but A to Z is his name. The librarian's name is A to Z. Anyway, back to the phones we go. Andrew in Dallas, Texas, watching on YouTube. Andrew, welcome. Go ahead with your question.
Hello. Yeah, so I'm a Catholic convert. I just converted last year to Catholicism from Protestantism.
Welcome on.
I guess my question would be, because my family, they're all Protestants. So I say, like, what's the best way to evangelize them? Because I tried talking to church history about them, but they weren't interested or anything like that. So what would you guys say is, like, the best way to evangelize the Protestant people about Catholicism?
Well, there is no one best way to evangelize Protestants, because Protestants are not all the same person. And so they have different approaches, work for different folks. And so you have a knowledge of your family better than I do. So you're going to know better than me. I can only give you some general principles. One of the principles is, don't expect too much, because you're a fellow family member. And as Jesus said, a prophet has no honor in his own family. You know, so like if you're evangelizing your parents, they're thinking, whether they say it or not, is, come on, I changed your diapers. Who are you to tell me about God? And similarly, if you've got brothers and sisters, they're going to be like, oh yeah, you're telling me about God, but I remember when you were mean to me as a kid and stuff like that. And so families have a tendency to discount messages from fellow family members about important stuff like religion, hence Jesus is saying. But that's not to say we shouldn't try. We should just try in a way that is sensitive to this kind of reaction. So you don't want to come on too strong. You want to be winning. You want to show them that you can be a good Catholic. You know, you've just recently converted, and that can make a good opportunity to discuss the faith with them. But if you've already tried that and they're not responding, then I would say, we'll take a different approach, you know, back off and just focus on being a good Catholic and being a good person and showing them that you can be a good Catholic and a good person. As you see opportunities, you might think of indirect things that you do. Like, you might say, hey, you know, I really get a lot out of Catholic worship. Maybe you'd like to come to Mass with me sometime. Or, you know, maybe you'd like to come to Mass just to satisfy your curiosity about what this Catholic thing is all about. And if they respond to that and they show some interest, well, maybe you want to hook them up with an inquirer's class at your parish. What you're doing in this case would be encouraging to get some exposure, but you're letting other things like the liturgy or the inquirer's class teachers engage with them. So it's not so personally difficult as talking to you, because, you know, family members care about each other. Sometimes they're really mad with each other, and that ramps up the emotional stakes of the conversation. And the higher the emotional stakes are, the more people tend to dig in their heels. And so you can lower the emotional temperature if you can involve other situations that aren't direct discussions about should you be Catholic or not. So, you know, like I said, your family members are your family members, not mine, and they'll respond to different things. One other general principle that I would mention is, you know, if you end up in discussions about the faith with them, ask them, you know, what are their questions they would like answered? Ask them, are there objections or concerns that they have about Catholicism? And then, you know, do the work to research whatever it is they're interested in knowing or whatever they're interested in hearing a response to. But asking questions of someone to figure out where they are and what they respond to, if they're even in a position where they're willing to respond, is a first step in evangelization. So that would be the general advice I'd have to give you.
And I'm going to say thank you, Andrew, for the call. I'm going to the lines have continued full. I'm going to try to get everybody on this hour if I can. So we'll open up the lines for next hour. But we'll see if there's success in that. Thanks, Andrew. Ryan is in Azusa, California, watching on YouTube. And this is how the A to Z conversation started. I learned from Jimmy that Azusa stands for A to Z USA. Hi, Ryan.
Hi. So I have a question. So I know that the church teaches that universalism is wrong, which is like everybody isn't going to be saved. But I also understand that it teaches about invincible ignorance, which is where if you don't fully understand God and it's not your fault, you might not go to hell because of that. And I'm just wondering, because like I feel like if somebody truly understands God and the faith and stuff, they'll come to it. And if they don't, then I feel like they missed something. So what's kind of the line there where you're not like, it's not universalism, but like, how does that work?
Okay, well, the first thing is that the church teaches, what it teaches is that hell is a real possibility. And so any system that would say hell is not a possibility would be inconsistent with church teaching. On the other hand, that's a separate question than how many people go to hell. And there have been Orthodox Catholic authors like Hansurs von Balthasar, who John Paul II named a cardinal for his theological contributions, who held that even though we can't say with certainty that God ensures the salvation of all folks, that we nevertheless could hope that God ensures the salvation of all folks. How he would do that is up for debate. I mean, because we don't even know that he does do that. But there, I just mentioned that because there, even though it's a minority position historically, there have been a few authors who have suggested that God might find a way to save everybody, even though hell's a real possibility. One way of doing that might be God enlightens the person at the moment of death and reveals himself to them and enables them to make a free choice for or against him. And in those circumstances, sense of God's presence might be so overpowering that they choose God, that everybody does. And so no one ends up going to hell, even though they could have if they had rejected God. I'll also note, now that's a minority position, like I said, but it's not completely inconsistent with church teaching. I would say that we also have some evidence against that in the form of near-death experiences, about 20% of which are negative, and some of them are positively hellish. And so the evidence we have from near-death experiences could indicate that not everybody goes to heaven, that some people really do choose to reject God fundamentally and spend eternity without him. Your question, though, was about invincible ignorance. Well, okay, so invincible ignorance is what one has. I think it's better to call it innocent ignorance, where someone just innocently doesn't know the facts about, you know, God and Jesus and his church. Invincible makes it sound, even though that's the historic term that's used here, it makes it sound like Superman level invincibility, that they just are, they have this ignorance that no amount of data could shatter. And that's not how the church or moral theologians understand this concept. I think referring to innocent ignorance is a better way. But even if someone's invincibly innocent of the truths about God and Jesus and his church and so forth, that doesn't mean he's in a state of grace. You know, someone could be a hardened adulterer or a murderer or something like that, and be innocently ignorant, not of the truth that murder is wrong and adultery is wrong, but that they need to convert and become a Christian. So just because someone's innocently ignorant, that's not a ticket to heaven. There can be people who are innocently unaware of the fact that Jesus is the Son of God and they need to believe in him, but they may be living a life where they do know adultery is wrong and embezzlement is wrong and theft is wrong and murder is wrong, and yet they do those things, which would mean they're not in a state of grace. So in addition to being innocently ignorant in order to go to heaven, you're going to need to be in a state of grace. You're going to need to have the virtue of love or charity in your soul. And you're not going to have that if you lead a life of unrepented mortal sin.
Ryan, I hope that was helpful to you and was very clear to you. Again, lines are full, so on we go. John's in Bel Air, Texas. John, thank you for waiting. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hi, I was wondering whether I could be in good standing with the church, a Catholic in good standing, if I personally oppose abortion based on my religion, but don't think, but I at the same time do not believe that the government should criminalize it. To give more detail, I believe based on scripture that at the moment of conception, a gift from God comes into existence. For example, Jeremiah 1:5 says, "Before I formed you in the womb, I knew you."
Okay, John, I appreciate the speed at which you're going, since we're getting close to the end of the hour, but you're going a little too fast for me to process everything you're saying. Can you relax and slow it down a little bit?
I'm sorry about that.
No problem.
To give more context, my view is basically a former President Joe Biden, a Catholic. I personally oppose abortion based on my religion, but I don't feel that I have the right to legislate or impose my religious beliefs on, the rest of society. And so I was wondering, can I be a Catholic in good standing if I, personally oppose abortion, but don't think the government should make it illegal? That's what I, yeah.
Okay, well, it depends on what you mean by in good standing. One, it's good that you believe what the church teaches, that abortion is wrong. The church also has a social teaching that that it should be criminalized, if at all possible in a given circumstance, because human life is human life and it needs protection. But that doesn't mean if you rejected the two teachings have different levels of magnitude. That abortion is wrong, that's infallibly certain. The idea that it should be criminalized, though, can be more dependent on circumstances, because there can be circumstances in history where even though something is wrong, that doesn't mean that it should be criminalized in this situation. For example, adultery. That's 100% wrong, just like abortion is. But even doctors of the church, like St. Augustine and St. Thomas Aquinas, held that in their day, that lust was so prevalent that prostitution should not be criminalized. Now, fortunately, we live in a day where they said that if it were criminalized, the world would be overturned in lust. Well, we're living in a day where we're fortunate that that's not the case now. I can't speak to Augustine's day or Aquinas's day, but now prostitution has been criminalized and the world is not, going to hell in a handbasket as a result. You could hypothetically argue that the same is true of abortion, but that's a tough argument to sell, because killing somebody is different than adultery. Let me ask you a question, John. Do you think that born children should have their lives legally protected?
Yes.
Okay, then why would you hold that unborn children should not have their lives legally protected in our culture today?
Well, because I think the belief that it's a child, that an embryo is a child, is a religious concept. I mean, because religions have disagreed with it, the point at which ensoulment occurs, that's something religions have disagreed with forever.
Okay, so what I would recommend, since we're coming up to the break, Si, why don't we see if we can send John a copy of the book, Why We're Pro-Life, And okay. It will go in more detail into how you don't need to be religious at all to recognize that an unborn child is still a child. And there are a lot of arguments about, well, we don't know when ensoulment occurs, that really dodge the issue. So we'll send you a copy of this book, John. Check it out. And if you'd like to discuss it further, call us back.
You're always welcome to call back, John. Just hang on. Why We're Pro-Life, a book from the Catholic Answers Press. We love giving those books away, and you can get them also at shop.catholic.com if you're interested in that. John, yours is free. Right back after just a very brief break with more Ask Me Anything with Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live.